news.
Quiet, please.
Ladies and gentlemen.
You ready for the big show?
You're ready.
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one fat-ass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
He is an existential threat to democracy.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Tina Kotek, as far as I'm concerned, is one of the biggest liars on the political scene in the Pacific Northwest. Now, I'm going to back that up because all people liars. I mean, there are plenty of people who call this show the naysayers, and they'll say, Donald Trump's a liar. And the first thing you do is say, what did he lie about? And they immediately get that blank stare. Well, I'm not sure. I can't remember one right offhand. I'm going to tell you exactly what I think Tina Kotek is lying about lately. I mean, not that she hasn't lied about other things. The $500,000 in campaign contributions that she got in stolen cryptocurrency that was illegally donated to the Democrat Party 4 years ago. I mean, there is that. And there are a number of other things she's done. But the thing I want to go after is her stance on data centers. Before I do that, welcome to the Lars Larson Show on a Wednesday. Welcome to the Radio Northwest Network, where we try on a daily basis to supply honestly provocative talk for the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho. Glad to have you with me. If you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it's here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And you can vote in our poll on X. Should the taxpayers pay a parent to stay home and raise their own kids? I would answer that one no. You can answer it any way you like. I'll give you further explanation a bit later. But you'll find today's poll on X at Lars Larson Show on X. You can also find it on my website at LarsLarson.com. First, though, let's play a soundbite from Governor Tina Kotek, who is fighting for her very existence. She understands that she has been abandoned by many of her friends in the labor unions, that she's got some of the lowest approval ratings of any governor in the United States of America. She has been a colossal failure when it comes to crime. She has been a colossal failure on the subject of education. She's been a failure on just about everything. And the only thing she's succeeded at, and I will give her this, she succeeded at saying that she's anti-Donald Trump. So much so that when Donald Trump came out and made positive statements about data centers, one of the most contentious issues that's being discussed throughout the United States, Governor Kotek decided, now's the time for me to take a stance against data centers. Take a listen to this.
President Trump says data centers should be fast-tracked by the Environmental Protection Agency. I say not in Oregon and not on my watch. President Trump also warned that Americans opposing data centers will wind up, quote, backwards and poor. And again, I say not in Oregon and not on my watch.
Oh boy, what a proud stand that Governor Tina Kotek has made. If Trump is for it, she's against it. Only problem with that is she has backed tax breaks for data centers totaling in the last 12 months, $450 million. That means that over the last several years, billions of dollars of tax breaks that have gone to the data centers. Now, what has she done specifically? And I'll cite this one because I don't like to call anybody out, even a really failed politician like Tina Kotek, without giving you the specifics. House Bill 4084. Now, what would that bill have done? It would have incentivized broader infrastructure investments by expanding property tax exemption windows. Critics pointed out, hey, it gives some really special breaks to data centers. Now, Governor Kotek backed House Bill 4084. And yet today, she'd have you believe, I'm against data centers. And why is she against data centers? In her heart of hearts, if she told you the truth, she'd say, I'm against them because Donald Trump's in favor of them, and I have to oppose anything Donald Trump does. So she has come out and appeared at an anti-data center rally outside the Capitol building, lending her support to calling for lawmakers to pass a temporary data center ban when they convene next year. In other words, she wants another term as governor. She knows she is unlikely to get it. In fact, I was just considering that question today because a couple of my colleagues, I did a podcast with Steve Dunn and Natalie Marmion that airs on the podcast of our flagship station, KXL. And they said, do you think that Tina Kotek can lose? I said, absolutely. I mean, Christine Drazen, I admit, was not my first choice, but she is the Republican nominee, and I'm backing her against Tina Kotek. Can she win? Yes. Chris Dudley came within about 22,000 votes of beating the Republicans. So, can Christine Drazen win? She can. Now, why would I believe that this is the year that's going to happen after 40 years of Democrat governors? Democrat governors, ever since vote by mail, came in full force in the state of Oregon. Now, why would I believe that this is the year it can happen? Number one, Kotek has abysmally low approval ratings. Number two, her favorite friends, the labor unions, have said, we're not going to back her. They're not going to back Drazen, but they're not going to back Tina Kotek. The donations are down. She doesn't have the stolen cryptocurrency to depend on now. And then she's doing crazy things like this, coming out and saying, I oppose data centers. Why? Because Donald Trump's in favor of it, and because it's the flavor of the week, even though she has backed tax breaks for data centers worth hundreds of millions over the years, billions of dollars of tax breaks for data centers. But all of a sudden, she's against them, but only temporarily. Notice that? She only wants to be temporarily against the data centers. So why would I believe anything Tina Kotek says? If she says, well, I'm against data centers temporarily. Till when, Governor Kotek? Well, till after the November election, till the regular session of the legislature next year. So you're going to be against them from November when the election is held all the way to January or February? Wow. Wow. You're going to oppose those data centers for two or three whole months. And why is she doing it? She says she supports data center moratoriums, but as governor, her options are more limited. The new order is as close as she can come. Well, she's already gone out and said, we're going to stop issuing easements, rights of way, leases, rentals, land use permits. You and I both know that anything a governor in this state or Washington state wants to oppose, they can set up the apparatus of government in the way of any proposal that they want stopped. They can stop the permits. They can stop all of it. And you know this. They have done this with so many things that they should not have opposed in both Oregon and Washington. They can certainly do it with data centers today. The fact that Tina Kotek says, oh, I don't have any power to do this. Well, she wrote a memo, and she only wrote it in September the 14th, right? September the 14th. She said no later than September 14th. Her memo says, if your agency is involved in any requests involving data center easements, please pause the work immediately and submit a status report to me no later than September the 14th, coming up 5-6 days from now. So she's going to oppose the data centers temporarily, and then the minute she's reelected to her second term, the one after which she is term limited out, she'll go right back to the regular course of business. So, you think I'm right in saying that Tina Kotek is lying to you right now, and she's doing it to save her own hide come November, or frankly, since the ballots go out in about a month in October? You're listening to the Lars Larson Show.
Peace. 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-HEY-LARS. Now, back to the Lars Larson Show.
That makes a lot of sense. A lot of nonsense.
Right. You're bloody well right. You know you got a right to say.
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
Pumped by River City Environmental. That great moment every day where Lars brings you the cold, hard facts without any liberal wokeness from the Daily Dead fish wrapper or mainstream media bias.
Hey, welcome back. And I got to tell you something. Mayor Katie Wilson of the city of Seattle, this woman who's never had a real job in her life, who's dependent on her parents for just about everything, and now she finds herself way over her head as mayor of America's 13th biggest city. And then what happened last weekend? Three people killed in a 24-hour period, four other people wounded in a series of shootings in and near the Belltown neighborhood over the Labor Day weekend. So what does she propose? She says, this weekend is tragic and unacceptable. Yeah, that's great, Mayor Wilson. It's unacceptable. What are you going to do about it? Well, she's announced that she's going to have a gun violence prevention strategy. Now, what she really needs, and I'm going to tell you a few elements of it, is not a gun violence prevention strategy, because guns by themselves are not violent. People can be violent, but people can be violent with guns or baseball bats or knives or just about anything else. So having a gun violence prevention strategy right out of the gate, you understand this is a flawed policy from a very flawed so-called leader, the mayor of the city of Seattle. It's tragic and unacceptable. So what does she say they're going to do about it? She said the city would focus on community violence intervention, focused deterrence, public safety, and public health investments while proposing additional staffing to support what she calls gun violence prevention work. You mind if I deconstruct a little bit of that? Community violence intervention. What does that mean? Well, it means that in many of the cases, both the shooting at the Bite of Seattle just a few weeks ago and the shootings over Labor Day weekend, I would imagine the police have already told Mayor Katie Wilson an awful lot of this involves gang activity or drug activity or gang drug activity or all three. So you know where it's coming from. So what is this community violence intervention? You're going to hire a bunch of people who will tell you they're going to go out and they're going to talk to the gang members and get them not to be violent anymore. Good luck with that. And then focused deterrence. What is focused deterrence? I mean, as far as I'm concerned, there are ways to deter activities. Tell people if you do it, you'll be convicted of a crime. That has some deterrence value. If you do something, we're going to lock you up in prison or in jail. That has some deterrence. But the usual nonsense that they're shoveling out, and then public safety and public health investments. You can better believe it's not going to be closed circuit cameras, because Mayor Wilson understands the public doesn't like those. Even though, wouldn't it be kind of convenient at this point to have some video of the guy who was involved in the shooting at the Bite weeks ago, where people were shot and you don't have a picture of the guy and you don't know who he is? If the solution does not involve one, more police on the payroll. Two, more arrests of law-breaking criminals. Three, more prosecutions. And I think Mayor Wilson is perfectly capable of using the bully pulpit to go after the prosecutors and say, look, you're going to bring serious charges against these people. And if you don't, we're going to run you over the coals. And then more bad guys sent to jail. As far as I'm concerned, until she gets those four, more cops, more arrests, more prosecutions, and more bad guys going to jail, all of the above is just window dressing from Mayor Katie Wilson. But I guess maybe that's the best you can expect from somebody who's never really done any kind of job. Our question of the day, brought to you by Multnomah Medical Clinic. No pills, no shots, no surgery. Fix what's actually causing the problem at Multnomah Medical Clinic. About those shootings, is it a crime to pull a trigger? Rick Ellison wrote in, Lars, honestly, I didn't know it was illegal to pull a trigger. I've pulled a lot of triggers. I never hurt anybody. I hope I never get arrested for trigger pulling. You know what he's talking about? The acting police chief in Seattle, they don't even have a permanent police chief yet, but the acting police chief is no longer calling the people who fire shots in downtown Seattle. They don't call them shooters anymore, even though shooter was not a very good term. They're going to call them trigger pullers, and that's exactly what the acting police chief did. Or Rick Ellison said, I don't like calling anything something it is not. Murderers are murderers. Rapists are rapists. Pedophiles are pedophiles. Calling them anything else is undermining the victims. Love your work. Signed, Rick Ellison. And now today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you completely insane? ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe they're just really, really stupid.
Presented by Oregon City Garage Door.
I want to give today's Daily Grill to Oregon Secretary of State Tobias Reid, who, by the way, is out telling everybody who will listen a very contradictory message. On one hand, he says Oregon's vote-by-mail system is a solid, trustworthy system for voting and counting the votes of citizens. On the other hand, he says, but don't trust the mails. Drop your ballot in a drop box. Now, do the two of those make sense? Tobias Reid would have you believe we've got a great system because it's vote-by-mail, but don't trust your ballot to the voting, to the mail to deliver your ballot to the elections headquarters. That doesn't make any sense at all. And so he gets today's Daily Grill. My favorite post on social media, Dagny Taggart posted this. Lars, I wanted to talk about the people you talked about yesterday, kicked out of the bar in Portland for wearing an offensive T-shirt. Can you imagine Chick-fil-A kicking somebody out for wearing an offensive pride shirt? The left would be rioting in the streets and breaking the windows in Chick-fil-A restaurants around the country. The party that claims to be one of tolerance and diversity is literally nothing more than the party of fascists, and they know it. They've taken a piece of Marxist advice to accuse your enemy of that which you are doing. They know that they're the fascists, but they think they can deflect by pointing fingers. It's laughable. Glad to hear you back today. Hope you had some nice time with your family. Thanks for all you do. Signed, Dagny Taggart. Well, she's absolutely right. Think about this. The sports bra, which is this feminist bra, feminist bar that was set up specifically to watch women's sports. And then some women showed up over the weekend, but they were wearing XXXY shirts supporting specifically women in sports. And the sports bra kicked them out. They kicked them out because they didn't like the message that these women oppose the idea of letting biological males compete against real women and real girls, and they couldn't tolerate that message. That's right. The party of tolerance has no tolerance for any point of view but its own. Glad to be with you on a Wednesday. Glad to take your calls. 866-439-5277. It's the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Show. Portland's news. Have something to say but don't want to talk? Email Lars at talk@larslarson.com. Now, back to the Lars Larson Show.
Hey, welcome back to the program and welcome back to the Radio Northwest Network. Consider this. One of the best things that public school systems do in both Oregon and Washington is maintain empty buildings. That's right. They keep those schools. They'll stay in the neighborhoods. It keeps the real estate values up. But does it actually do any good for the kids? No, I don't think it does. But to talk about it, Aaron Mesh joins us now, managing editor at Willamette Week. You can find their stories at WWeek.com. So, Aaron, Portland public schools are losing students hand over fist. And now they're talking about closing as many as 20 of its elementary and middle schools. And yet the teachers union is going to call to keep the schools open?
It's looking that way for sure. So have we talked about this issue before? I can't remember.
I think we have in passing. I know I brought it up before because it angers me that you'd spend money on empty buildings instead of spending money on educating children, which I thought was the point.
So the big question that PPS faces, the existential crisis that PPS faces, which I know you and I have talked about, is the fact that enrollment continues to drop, that that the district will almost certainly be dropping by another 10 to 18% of student body in the next 10 years. It is already seeing precipitous declines as the student body continues to shrink, and it's shrinking for reasons that that I think I've outlined with you before, which have to do with families fleeing the city of Portland, other families choosing to pull their kids out of the public school system and go to private schools or homeschooling. But the pool is shrinking of students, and the pool of teachers hasn't shrunk with them, and the pool of buildings hasn't shrunk with them. So the reality is that you're facing a depleted customer base, if you want to be crass about it.
Yep.
And when you have fewer customers, you need fewer buildings to serve them. The same kind of contraction that leads to like a McDonald's or a Burger King shuttering. If there are just too many on one block, they close down. And that's what's happening to the school system. And the reality, of course, when you shut down, if there's no longer a McDonald's on Foster in 82nd, and there's just one up in Monteville in 82nd, that means that there's going to be a lot less burger flippers when you shrunk the number of McDonald's by half. And I use this analogy because it just seems to me that like some of the basic economics seem to be lost on the teachers union when understanding what it is that's going to have to happen when you have a depleted customer base like this.
Yeah, and there's a way to turn it around, but it's not what the public schools have been doing lately, especially, you know, we pointed out earlier this week, having a drag queen welcoming all the kids back to school in a video message from the district doesn't seem like the way to communicate to parents you take the education of the kids seriously. And so you have fewer teachers, and yet the teachers union may say keep those buildings open, but how does that benefit the teachers?
Well, it benefits the teachers because there are more jobs. So when you eliminate a building, that means that that you are going to begin eliminating some of the support staff in that building. Very likely, right. If you eliminate an elementary school and you go from like two neighborhood elementary schools to one neighborhood elementary school, well, you just lost a principal. You probably just lost an assistant principal. So the question is, like, bus them back down to being teachers inside that school? And if you bus them back down to being teachers, well, then suddenly you probably have a couple too many teachers inside that new contracted school because the principal's now a teacher, right? So like now, like, there's a question of like who's going to get bumped out at that point, and probably it's the most recently hired teacher. So look, the unions have a job to do. The unions are going to advocate for their membership. I think what makes this sort of interesting is that parents also don't like when a neighborhood school closes. And so if you have a teachers union that is advocating for its membership not to close the school because it's bad for the teachers, at least in the short term, although long term there are enormous benefits to teachers in closing schools. If you have the teachers union looking at the short term about how many jobs they're going to lose, and you have parents looking at the short term of not wanting their kids to have to further away from home to go to school, and you have a school board that is filled with Quislings who are terrified of alienating their union backers, then you may have a process that isn't going to end in a district that is the right size.
I guess what I wonder is they know the school district's in financial trouble. They know the number of kids is declined. It used to be in the 50,000 range. Now it's about 42,000. And as you said, it's going to drop another, you know, maybe 18% over the next 10 years. So as long as you keep employing a lot of teachers and teachers you don't need for the students that you have, then you're not going to have the money to pay them. But if you actually reduced the number of teaching positions and you have fewer teaching positions and the same amount of money, then you'll have more money to pay each of those teachers and you won't have the budget problems anymore. And if you look at their most recent numbers, Aaron, this ought to stun anybody, because I know there are people who listen to what I say about it and they say, oh, you're just wrong. Okay, let's take their own numbers. 43,000 students, 42,785, 2,700 educators. You know what the ratio of that is? It's 16 kids per teacher. I mean, that sounds like the best private schools out there. And yet you'll hear everybody say, oh, we've got these overcrowded classrooms and we got 40 kids crammed in with every teacher. Well, the math doesn't suggest that's the truth. It suggests more like it's 16 to 1, doesn't it?
Well, it does. I understand from talking to Joanna, who wrote this story. Joanna Ho is the reporter on this
good
story.
Right.
The allocations across classrooms are going to vary, right? Like, there are some high schools in which there are a bunch more kids, and there are some middle schools in which there are a bunch less kids. Like, it's never going to be as clean as 16 to 1 per classroom. But your basic math is correct. And I think another really important statistic is that from 2017 until now, we've seen an enrollment decline of 10%. During that same time, we've seen a contraction of teachers via layoffs or other reasons, a personnel decline in teachers of only 1%. So what that means is that, again, the labor reality isn't matching the customer base. So that's a mass problem. That's an economics problem. There's politics here, but one of the things that drives me a little bit crazy is when we have political conversations that don't seem to be rooted in like a basic understanding of shared facts. Those numbers don't change no matter how you like shift them around and stare at them from different angles. It's not a magic eye painting.
No, like, consider this. The other story that Willamette Week has done a fantastic job on, the $500 million high schools that Portland is building right now, that are some of the most expensive high schools in the United States of America, bar none, at almost $500 million apiece. And at the same time they're building these massive big high schools, they're losing the students. You can read the latest story at WWeek.com. Aaron Mesh is its managing editor. Back in a moment. An Oregon sanctuary law let a convicted child abuser walk free again and again. We'll get to that next.
So,
all right.
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one fat-ass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
He is an existential threat to democracy.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back, Lars Larson Show. So you think your TV set is off. Well, what does off actually mean? And could your TV set actually be listening to you when you think the machine is not even turned on and does not have electricity flowing to it? Well, a new investigation says your so-called smart TV could be actually listening in on you. So I knew it was time to check in with our tech expert, Brian Westbrook, who joins us now. Brian, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Lars. I'm always listening in on you.
Well, I appreciate that. But I mean, I know that for a lot of people, they believe, well, this is just this is internet rumor or hype. That our smart TVs are actually listening to us, but it seems they actually are, aren't they?
Yeah, and in some cases it needs to listen to you, and I'll get into that in just a moment, but I want to first start by saying that some 216 million TVs could be listening to what you're saying in the room, and there's a reason for it, but LG, the manufacturer of these TVs, has said, of course, it is not true that the TVs do not listen to you, and here's where it is actually paying attention, and the TVs are not, as you say in the intro, off, and that has to do with the wake word. So all of these smart devices, whether it be a smart speaker, whether it be, a toaster oven, or in this case, your television, have to rely on you saying, hey, I'd like to pay attention to this device. I'm talking to you. So it's rather than me calling you and saying, hey, Lars, you're saying, hey, name of device, right? And that wakes up the device. And that's the key point at which now the device is listening and transmitting information, what you say, the words, the commands, the instructions that you give this electronic device, to the over the internet, to whatever service it is using, it's calling, maybe it's accessing programming, or it's giving you information or the weather or that kind of thing. But without that wake word, the electronic device manufacturers will tell you it is not able to transmit to the internet and transmit out to the greater world. So effectively, it's listening for that wake word, but it's not listening for anything else. Now, that's what they'll tell you, but we as consumers have to trust that that is accurate, and in some cases, that may not be the case. And this Gamers Nexus report that says it is transmitting information is certainly not reassuring for those that are already a little bit paranoid about electronic devices spying on you.
Well, and that's the other thing I'm curious about, because I understand the point you're making that the TV needs to be able to listen to fulfill certain functions if you want those functions.
Yeah,
but shouldn't
those
always be an opt-in? So you buy the device, and at some point during the, you know, when you're first turning these devices on, and they ask you which language you're speaking and what part of the world do you live in and all the rest of that garbage, that at some point they should say, by the way, we have a mode that we can be in which your TV set will listen for you to give it instructions if you want to turn it on. But unless you turn it on, we won't turn it on. But that's not the way they engineer these things right now, is it?
That's correct. And the reason for that is quite simple, because these are smart speakers. These are smart devices. And if you don't have that enabled, you're not getting, quote unquote, what you paid for. Now, I think there is an opportunity. There is an appetite for two things. One, for consumers to be more aware of what they're getting into and to actually read those screens that they're clicking next. Because in a lot of cases, you do have to approve the privacy. You do have to opt in. And I'm not suggesting that it's bold and center and front and obvious and it's clear English. Sure. Right. So, let's suggest that it's an 8-point font, and maybe it does require a little bit of caution and a little bit of like, okay, what am I reading? Should I click on the privacy policy? Should I actually read what I'm agreeing to? And I think that's up to us as consumers. It's also up to the manufacturers to be a little more clear about what's happening under which scenarios. Even if I'm buying a smart device, I should have some reasonable assurance and sort of a two-way street, if you will, of what this is doing and under what scenarios.
Okay, and the other piece to this is, you say it's not necessarily transmitting what you're saying or what it's hearing from you, but could somebody hack into it and say, I'm going to listen in on what Brian Westbrook is doing at his home when he's unaware that I'm listening? Because that seems, there are plenty of creepy people out there who'd probably do that even if there wasn't a potential financial gain. And I would imagine there is a way to turn that into potential financial gain.
Yeah, and certainly that's a concern, and that's something we've seen in other scenarios. Remember security cameras. You and I have talked about this over the years of things that can be hacked and can be exploited, that even if you are willing to sign up for that contract we just talked about, and you are willing to opt in or say, yes, this is a feature that I'm willing to accept, that's assuming that everything is going correctly. And I think this brings me into, again, some consumer responsibility. And I don't want anyone to walk away from this thinking that Brian is thinking that the consumer needs to be the only person responsible for this. It is a multi-pronged problem here, but one of the things that we need to be careful with is a TV is not a TV that you and I grew up with anymore. It is a computer on the wall with a big display now, and that means it requires updates, it requires maintenance, it requires knowing exactly what it's doing. If you think that a TV is an appliance, you're wrong. It's a computer with a giant display. There is no such thing as a television anymore with the old turn knobs and the remote control that you could never find. Those days are long gone. If you have a TV in your house, consider it like any computer where you need to update it, you need to know what it's doing on the internet, you need to watch the traffic, and maybe if you're gone or you're having a sensitive conversation in the room, completely pull it from the wall, unplug it from its internet, turn it off, disable the thing completely. I mean, if you're telling trade secrets in your living room, maybe unplug your TV.
Yeah, and I guess the only thing I would like to see is I'd like to see the manufacturers say, we understand there are some people who completely reasonably want to have their privacy, even if the hacking in may be only theoretical at this point.
Sure.
Is it possible they're going to start listening to that and say, we're going to let you opt into this or not opt into it? Your choice.
Yeah, and there already are some controls in the settings of most televisions that give you some flexibility, but I think this is a great case where, you know, these things do, they come back and forth and back and forth. This is going to be a great conversation to have, and I think manufacturers are going to respond to consumer pressure and say, we need to make it more transparent, we need to make it easier for guests to understand, for users to understand what their television is or isn't capable of doing, and let the consumer, let the person who's putting that TV on the wall in their living room decide how far into this mess they want to get, or if they're, you know, perhaps they're perfectly acceptable. They're like, listen, if you want to listen in on my conversation, feel free. You're going to be awfully bored.
I mean, because I would imagine that the folks who run these big companies that make these TVs have probably read 1984, and they may in fact have gone to college, and they're aware that this is one of the spooky things that people, including George Orwell, said, hey, what if someday the government or whomever could actually listen in on everything you say and do, and wouldn't that be scary? And then the folks graduate from college having read 1984 and go off and start a company that actually puts this together. You can find his work at brianwestbrook.com online. He is our tech expert and a longtime friend of the show. That's Brian Westbrook. Glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Coming up, Lindsay Clancy admits to killing her three kids, but jurors say the prosecution was too harsh. Can you believe that? We'll get to that in just a moment. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. If you're losing it,
local, national, Lars has you covered. Call him from anywhere. 866-HEY-LARS. Now, back to the Lars Larson Show.
This is the definition of reason of go. But he had the hardest time getting off the fact that Lindsay viciously killed her children.
You know, it's absolutely unbelievable to me that those are the comments of a juror in a case involving a mother who killed her three children. Nobody debates that Lindsay Clancy took the lives of her three children. The only question to be resolved by the jury, and it was never really resolved in this trial because it ended in a mistrial, and they may have to try her again. And I honestly hope they do try her again. I think there is real justice that's available for those three children, but if the prosecutor decides not to prosecute Lindsay Clancy again, then those kids get no justice whatsoever. But that comment, just couldn't get over the fact that she viciously killed her children. Yeah, no kidding. I would hope that no reasonable human being would be able to get over the idea that a woman would take three small children, wrap her hands around their necks, and use exercise bands, and then squeeze hard for 3 minutes, according to the testimony at trial, and take the life from those three children. I would hope that nobody would be able to say, well, I kind of got past the stuff about her killing the kids, and I decided instead to decide whether or not she deserved to be punished. Do you know what they're saying now? Well, let me get to that in just a moment. First, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. If you want to join what we always call the best conversation in talk journalism, it's here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Naysayers always go to the head of the line. Always have. Always will. That's 30 years we've done that. 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And you can, well, you can always vote in our X poll. You'll find the poll question every day at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com. No. Here's what the Lindsay Clancy jurors are saying now. While they're out there defaming the one man on the jury was made up of nine women and three men. And one of those three men was the man who patriotically, I think, and courageously stood up and said, I am not going to vote for an acquittal of Lindsay Clancy. And thank God he didn't. Well, now the Lindsay Clancy jurors say the problem was how harsh the prosecutor was toward Clancy. Now, think about that comment, too. I mean, it's almost as unbelievable as, well, he just couldn't get over the fact that she viciously killed her children. Jurors who say, well, you know, the prosecution was kind of harsh when it came to this woman who strangled three little children. Listen to Clancy juror number one.
I just found it to be harsh, Sue. Very, very harsh. I mean, again, and maybe we were talking with ourselves here, but the fact that they had no character witnesses to, in regard to Lindsay, of being a bad mother. I mean, right out of the gate, it's like you're presenting all these medical professionals, but nobody's presenting, and for the prosecution, a woman and a mother of three children. So I found it to be biased right out of the gate.
Now, hold on a second. I want you to understand something that maybe this juror does not understand, because I find this jury to be absolutely bizarre. These 11 women who then, number one, decided that Lindsay Clancy was not guilty of a crime and did not deserve to be punished for murdering her three children. Again, she has a right to her day in court, and I imagine they will retry her. But apparently they don't understand the first thing about how a jury trial works. In the United States of America, when you are charged with a crime and you are then brought in for a trial and a jury is picked, the prosecution puts on its case first, and they make the case, hopefully beyond a reasonable doubt, that the defendant has committed the crime. That's the whole point of the prosecution, not to put on character witnesses for the defendant, not to go in and defend the honor of the woman accused of killing her kids. No, their job is to make the case beyond a reasonable doubt that she committed the crime and she deserves the punishment. It's not the prosecutor's job to, you know, give some character witnesses on behalf of Lindsey Clancy. Well, three of the jurors have really come out to defend what they did. They wanted to vote for an acquittal. They didn't get it because one of the jurors said no. And that is the American jury system. You have to get 12 yes votes to convict somebody. You also have to get 12 yes votes to acquit somebody. And Ronnie Carlson, the jury foreperson, retired fifth grade teacher, said that being unable to reach a unanimous verdict after a draining trial was awful, and it was an emotional roller coaster. Can you imagine? Carlson said she wrote the final note to the judge with a heavy heart. Listen to Clancy jury number two.
We weren't trying to figure out if she murdered the children. She did. And she's admitting that. We're trying to figure out, did she know right from wrong at that time? And with everybody saying she loved her children so much, and everything proved she loved her children, from her journals to her mother-in-law, everything proved that she loved her children, so she had to have snapped.
Now, hold on. Try to wrap your head around this. Everything proves she loved her children, including the testimony about her wrapping her hands and exercise bands around their necks and strangling them for 3 long minutes each to steal the life from them. Did that prove that she cared about her kids? And the problem is, this juror doesn't even sound like she understands real life. I mean, in real life, do you find that there are people who honestly love their kids and still do awful things to them? They honestly love their spouse, their husband or wife, and do awful things to them. I mean, the world and real life is full of people who honestly do love their kids, love their families, love the people around them, and still end up doing awful things to them. The fact is, it wasn't a question of, did she love her kids? The question was, did she understand that what she was doing was wrong? I think it's easy to make that case. Lindsey Clancy sent her husband off on an errand to pick up food, to pick up medicine at the pharmacy. And when he called in the middle of running those errands and asked her if she was okay, she said, I'm fine. Go ahead, take your time, and come back. He took his time. When he arrived at the house, she was out in the yard having jumped from a second-story window. The kids were inside the house with the life strangled out of them. Yeah. She knew that what she was doing was wrong. That's why she sent her husband off on the errands. That's why she reassured him on the phone and said, go ahead, finish the errands, and then come home. Did she cry for help? No. Did she say, I'm hearing voices? Did she say, I'm murdering our children right now? No, not at all, because she knew that what she was doing was wrong. The jurors in this case did not, sadly. That's the Lars, and you're listening to the Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson Show. Portland's news, traffic, and weather. Follow the Lars Larson Show on X at Lars Larson Show. You never know what he'll post. Now, back to the Lars Larson Show.
Hey, welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you, and we made sure to pay the phone bill this week so that when we get Leland Vittard on, the host of On Balance and Chief Washington Anchor at News Nation, that we wouldn't lose touch with him. Hey, Leland, how are you doing today? Ah, look at that. We ended up, I'm beginning to think it's Leland's phone and not our phone, because every time this happens, we end up losing a connection with Leland. But We're going to get to that in just a moment. If you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it's here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And you can find our X-Poll question. The X-Poll question at the top of the list: should taxpayers pay a parent to stay home and raise their own kids? I would not be in favor of that, because I don't think it makes any sense for the government to pay you to do what is your job as a parent, and that is take care of your own children. So should the parents be paid to do that kind of duty? I would say no to that. You can vote on the poll on X any way you like. You'll find the question at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com. Oh, I see what happened. Leland dropped today because he had to leave for an emergency. Well, I'll tell you what. We've got a few other things on the agenda that I want to get in front of you. Let me tackle some of those first. And then we'll get to other matters, like the one that we had planned to talk to Leland about, a wider war with Iran, because U.S. SEALs and specialized underwater teams have been spending 4 months secretly clearing mines from the Strait of Hormuz, working mostly at night to avoid detection. This is all coming from a report by the Financial Times. The Navy sent robot boats and specialized underwater craft into the strait alongside human divers, part of a broader push to locate and dispose of mines without exposing more personnel than necessary to the threats in the area. So, do we have to worry that Donald Trump's war with Iran is going to go on much, much longer? We had expected it to end within weeks. It has now been going on for more than 6 months. Just today, we've seen oil go past $100 a barrel, and that is putting pressure on the American public and pressure on Donald Trump, because he has the midterm elections that are coming up. Ballots are going to start going out to Americans. Some of them are going to Americans overseas in the next couple of weeks. And most of the ballots will be out within about a month or so. So what's going to happen if we have to go that direction? Well, it's going to be a real problem. So we've got a few other things on our agenda. We had not planned for Leland to miss our opportunity today, but we'll catch up with him next week. Americans just paid over the Labor Day weekend the highest gas prices ever recorded, and that is on a Labor Day. That is $4.15 a gallon nationally. That shatters the previous record of $3.82 set in 2012. It marked the first time the holiday average topped $4. So that's a problem for Americans, and I would imagine it's going to be a problem for the president in the midterm elections, because we're going to end up with a problem if the Congress goes to the Democrats. If the Democrats take control of the House of Representatives, if they take control of the Senate, one or the other or both, we're going to have a problem. We're going to absolutely be in trouble, because you know what's going to happen. If the Democrats get a majority in the House of Representatives, the end result will be they're going to try to impeach Donald Trump one more time. It's crazy, but that's exactly what they do. A little update, by the way. When the last U.S. and allied soldiers had left Afghanistan about 5 years ago, remember the disastrous pullout during Joe Biden in 2021? Well, the Taliban fighters had seized billions of dollars worth of American-purchased military hardware. Pentagon figures released last year show that about $7 billion in hardware and weaponry fell into the group's hands when the Afghan National Army collapsed. 5 years later, the hardware of America's longest ever war, longer than Vietnam too, was still easy to spot on the streets of Kabul. Taliban fighters patrol in armored vehicles once supplied to Afghan forces. They wear American tactical gear. They carry American weapons. CBS News reports they saw one Humvee in the Afghan capital that still has a faded Green Bay Packers decal on it, a remnant from the previous operators of that Humvee. Oh, and then there's this. The guy who's been heading up for some time the United States Smithsonian Institution, he is a historian by the name of Lonnie Bunch III. He is going to step down as head of the Smithsonian by the end of the year. He's leaving. He is the Smithsonian's first black leader. It comes as the Trump administration has intensified its attacks on what it alleges is the institution's radical theology or ideology, threatening to withhold support and seeking to shape how it portrays America's past. Well, I think they're absolutely right. You've seen the Smithsonian turn into a political propaganda tool of America's political left. And apparently Lonnie Bunch has decided he doesn't want to be there anymore because the Trump administration is going to actually force him to run that institution in a way that is level, in a way that is fair and flat. And it should be run as a historical institution, and it should not be run as something that merely propagandizes on behalf of the Democrat Party. Oh, and then consider this. Are higher oil prices wiping out the income gains that Americans made earlier this year? Well, one of the people we trust on this subject is Steve Moore, the economist who has worked for Donald Trump in the past. Hotline and Unleash Prosperity has calculated the estimates of monthly income gains and losses based on the Census Bureau data. The estimates are within 1% of official numbers released about a year ago. They just ran the numbers through July of this year. And the good news is, after a four-year near-zero increase in real median household income under Joe Biden through the first 14 months of the Trump presidency, the number is up by $2,800. In other words, real income calculated against inflation-adjusted numbers. So, the bad news. Since the Iran conflict and the spike in oil prices, median household incomes have $800 on an annualized basis. So they were up $2,800. Now they're back down $800. So it's still a gain under President Trump of about $2,000. But voters are saying, well, but what are you doing for me now? The oil prices are back up again. Today we saw them go past $100 a barrel. That is absolutely crazy. Oh, and then there's this question. For this coming Friday, the 25th anniversary of the September 11th terrorist attacks on New York City, the question is whether or not New York City's Mayor Zohran Mamdani is going to speak at the memorial ceremony at Ground Zero. A Change.org petition is asking the 9/11 memorial organizers to reconsider including Mayor Mamdani of New York City. They've got almost 100,000 signatures as of last Saturday. Back in a moment. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Parking lot, industrial.
Take a peek inside Lars's studio. Follow him on Instagram at the Lars Larson Show. Now, more with Lars Larson.
Hey, welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails. This segment of the Lars Larson Show on the Radio Northwest Network is brought to you by NickShivers.com. Ready to stop being a landlord? My Rocket List lets you sell that property guaranteed, even with non-paying tenants. Go to NickShivers.com. That's NickShivers.com. And I'm glad to get your calls. If you want to join what we call the best conversation in talk journalism, it's here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And our poll on X today, found at Lars Larson Show, should taxpayers pay a parent to stay home and raise their own kids? I'd say no to that. I think it's a parent's job to raise their own kids. I understand it'd be nice to get a check from the taxpayers for that, but somebody explain to me how that makes sense, that we should pay you to raise your own kids. Now, if you have children that have particular medical problems and you need some assistance, I could see some help being offered there, but simply saying it's your job to raise your kids, so the taxpayers should write you a check, I don't think so. The poll on X can be found and at LarsLarson.com. And yesterday's poll, should New Mexico be renamed New America? I think Donald Trump is just trolling the liberals out there. But it was one of his suggestions on Truth Social. 64% of you said no to that idea. Only 36% of you said yes to the idea of renaming New Mexico as New America. Glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. My email of the day, brought to you by Multnomah Medical Clinic. No pills, no shots, no surgery. Fix what's actually causing the problem at Multnomah Medical Clinic. John in Independence writes in, Lars, what has never been said publicly in the U.S. is that 9/11 was the Muslim world's expression of faith and zeal for their religion, which considers non-Muslims to be infidels, chattel, and a lower form of life. The sacrificed jetliners, passengers, and crew were mere sheep to slaughter so that a few Muslim faithful could obtain martyrdom and life in paradise for eternity based on continuing to abuse women for the martyrs' entertainment and for good times. I don't and never will buy the line that there are good Muslims. No, you either are or are not a Muslim, and you either embrace that nihilism. It's a pox on mankind, and it's been around since the 8th century A.D. Listen hard to what the mayor of New York City says the day after tomorrow, before then and after then. Any prevarication is the real truth of what those in his ilk have had in mind for us infidels all along. Signed, John in Independence. Glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. I just saw an update on James Tallarico, who's running for the United States Senate out of Texas. And it seems he wants to win that race. So you know what he's done? It sounds like he's doing a 180 on the subject of transgender athletes. Consider this, quote, I oppose trans athletes playing in girls' sports if it endangers safety or fairness. Sounds like James Tallarico has just come around to a sensible point of view. Although he's trying to do it with a caveat in there, he only opposes it if it endangers safety or fairness. Well, let me ask you the question. If a biological girl is running against a biological boy, and biological boys are much faster in, say, track and field than biological girls, how could it ever be fair to make the biological girl compete against the biological boy? That's on the fairness issue. Now, when it comes to safety, how many times have we seen, say, a girl wrestler or a girl boxer who ends up getting beat up because she's boxing not against another girl, but against a biological boy? And then, of course, you've got the woman who used to play volleyball and was out of the sport because a male, a trans woman, but a man, a biological man who identified as a woman, hit that volleyball so hard and it hit her head so hard that she suffered permanent brain damage. So you see, this kind of position gives Senate Democrat nominee James Tallarico all the room in the world. He can simply say, I support trans athletes as long as it doesn't endanger safety or fairness, except that every one of those contests puts safety and fairness at risk. He said he would oppose trans athletes competing in girls' sports if it poses a risk to safety and fairness, a notable shift for a candidate who once claimed there are six biological sexes, and he said that God is non-binary. Now, I mean, I'd go along with the rest of you if you said, how does a guy like that ever plan to get elected from the great state of Texas when running for the United States Senate, taking the position that God is non-binary and that there are six biological sexes? He has since said that he knows there are only two sexes, and he acknowledged that some of his past remarks missed the mark. Yeah, you think so? Just a little bit outside is what I would suggest that James Tallarico is. But maybe he's figured out that if he sticks to his original positions, he's probably not going to end up being the winner when it comes to counting the votes on Election Day. And then there's this. Sam writes in, Lars, of course I'm not happy with the price of gas presently because we're on our annual RV road trip 2 weeks from now. But in the last 2 years, the prices were low enough to save us $500 every time we had a trip. So we're ahead of the game, even if this year costs us $500 more. RV only gets about 10 miles a gallon. However, gas will go lower soon, and the bad guys never get a nuke. Signed, Sam and Mary Phillips. And then there's Sue, who writes in, Lars, I believe there is a child care tax credit for parents who work. So it only seems fair that there should be a tax credit for those who stay home and take care of their own children. Maybe not a stipend, but at least a tax credit. Well, I think we're sliding more and more in the direction of socialism when you say it is the taxpayer's job to pay you to take care of members of your own family. If you actually believe that, I'd be glad to take the naysayer call. If you want to jump in, it's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network and the Lars Larson Show.
Larson Show. FM News 101. Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at the level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
He is an existential threat to democracy.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Hey, welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. You know, after 43 years and hundreds of arrests to its credit, Crime Stoppers of Oregon is now shutting down for good. Is technology killing one of the state's best crime-fighting tools? I thought we'd talk about that with a man I haven't talked to probably in a couple of decades, but I know him well, Henry Gripper, who is a retired Portland police officer and chair of Crime Stoppers of Oregon, where he's been involved with this program for more than 40 years. Henry, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you, Lars. It's been, yeah, you're right. It's been a couple of decades since we talked.
I think it has been. And you and I would occasionally have disagreements when it came to you, you know, speaking on behalf of the police department. But tell me this. Why would Crime Stoppers go away? What's putting it out of business?
Well, there's not just one thing, I don't believe, Lars. It's 43 years. And the original program was the brainchild of a detective in Albuquerque in 1976. We tried to get a Crime Stopper program going, but it wasn't until 1983 that a group got together, was able to raise some funds. It's quite a issue when it comes to being a Crime Stopper program. It's not just easy. You've got to be a 501c3 charitable nonprofit, board of directors, all volunteers, and you have a coordinator, which is the link between Crime Stoppers and law enforcement. And be honest with you, the board, I've got a couple of people are 80, but a lot of people have been with that board 20, 30, one guy, 40 years. The program's kind of gotten old, I believe, people looking at it, and, of course, the board's gotten old.
But the basic idea of offering up rewards to incentivize people to bring forward information to solve cases, is that too old-fashioned to continue operating in the modern age?
Well, you know, in the day, I go back, we go back a long time. Back, I want to say, in the late 1990s and into the 2000s, we had great statistics. And sadly, in the last 5 years, we've only cleared 8 cases.
Could you tell where the decline came from, though, Henry?
No, I really can't. We were once told that maybe our logo was old-fashioned, so we redid that to become more contemporary. We've actually went from a phone answering to a crime tip, so people can log into the app from their phone, tablet, and or computer and leave a tip. We don't know who they are. The tip would go to a place, Navigate 360, that hosts all the data for Crime Stoppers program. And believe it or not, there's approximately in total in the United States and Canada, there's about 400. But I know of no other Crime Stopper program that has lasted 43 years.
No, and in fact, it'd be nice to see it get to continue, because I always thought that was one of the ways of incentivizing people to come forward. I realize that, you know, somebody could say, well, Lars, shouldn't people do the right thing for nothing at all, for no financial reward? I said, yeah, but cash always works a whole lot better than just doing it because it's the right thing to do, doesn't it?
Right, yeah. And Crime Stoppers, I know that there was this issue. A lot of people are afraid to contact the police, fear of retaliation. If I get involved, they're going to know who I am, and something's going to happen to me or my family. And the other issue is there are people say, well, what's in it for me? Well,
yeah.
Crime Stoppers, you know, addresses both issues. So you get that. But, you know, we've tried different things. For example, years ago, we had a campus Crime Stopper. The Portland Public Schools, they had their own police department. And the chief of police and the superintendent and the school board thought having a campus Crime Stopper was a great idea. So we made posters, and they were posted in the schools. The first tip, Lars, was one regarding a young man in high school. In his backpack, he carried a gun and drugs he was selling. I remember
wow.
that one.
That's a heck of a tip, isn't it?
A lot of graffiti. Oh, it was a great tip. But what happens, there was a change in superintendent. There was a change in the school board, and they just didn't want to continue. So that went by the wayside.
Isn't that sad? Because you'd think if there were any, especially if you managed to control, to protect your source on that. Did Crime Stoppers ever have an instance where the people who reported something to Crime Stoppers were found out because of Crime Stoppers and ended up having retaliation? Because it sounds like you protected your sources pretty well.
No. We did. We, 43 years, we never had a problem. One of the issues, though, and, you know, the board has been looking at this. There's 10 members on the board, and the only reward they get is that satisfaction of doing a great job. But when you've only got 8 tips you've solved in the last 5 years, it is a little depressing. And they've been talking about maybe we're just old. We've outlived what we were created for here. It is, and, you know, I had the honor, I was told that, and you know, I cut those spots, radio spots, since 1983 all the way up to about a year ago, and we were said to have the longest continuously running public service announcement in Oregon history.
I believe it. Henry, thanks for all the good work.
We won awards. Well, thank you, Lars.
It is a pleasure to have you on. That's retired Portland police officer Henry Gripper, chairman of the Crime Stoppers of Oregon. He's been involved with the program since 1983, about 43 years ago. We're glad that he took part in that. Let me go to Ron in Tacoma. Hey, Ron, welcome to the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Well, what's on my mind is what I just heard him say. He just brought up the nonprofit issue, and I wanted to point something out to America, and you already know this. The whole reason we have nonprofits is the majority of nonprofits, they get that tax break, 501c3. They get that because a great deal of their staff, including like the board of directors, are not supposed to be paid. I'm just wondering where we went wrong in this country, because the whole point of 501c3s was that you were like a mini-government organization. And why is our government not being ran the same way? This is what the problem with our government is everybody's being paid, and nonprofits, nobody can get paid. How is it, you know, something's gone wrong here in the way we've done 501c3s.
I'm not sure I entirely agree with you, because even in a 501c3, you occasionally have to hire expertise, which you cannot get for free. But a 501c3 has to raise money. And then what you're telling the IRS is, most of the time, if you go out and you offer to let people give you money, and then you provide a service that's called a business, and you have to pay taxes on the money. But if you're doing it as a charitable function, then it's no longer a taxable event, and that's because of the 501c3. But hiring people to and paying them for their skills and their talents, I don't think there's anything wrong with that. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Need reading glasses, of course.
This is your home for honestly provocative talk radio. The truth every day. Now, back to the Lars Larson Show.
Hey, welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Well, the pilots are calling Amazon's cargo contractor Scare 21. Or 21 Scare. The actual name is 21 Air, and they were calling it by that name long before a deadly crash in Miami. Should Amazon be held responsible for who it trusted to fly its planes, or was it government regulators that were out of line in this case? Let me get into the details of this, and I'll cite my sources on it. This is very, very, very strange. But if you want to join the conversation, we certainly welcome you. If you want to join in, it's 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. So when we first heard about this crash, it happened on Sunday. It was an Amazon Prime Air Boeing 767 cargo plane. And at the time it happened, I'd heard the initial reports and I thought, I don't understand that one at all. I mean, I'm not a pilot. I'm not an aviation expert. But over the years, I've talked to enough pilots and enough aviation experts. I thought, I've never heard of a crash like this. So the airplane came in good weather. It was landing on a nice, clear runway. There was plenty of room. There didn't appear to be an in-flight emergency. There didn't appear to be any kind of emergency involving the aircraft itself or the engines or anything else. It just came in high and fast. It bounced one landing gear on the pavement, aborted a go-around too late, and then never deployed the reversers or the speed brakes. And they rolled this 32-year-old plane right through a cleaning crew's van on a public road. Five people who were inside that van never got away. The pilots walked away, and one of them told a bystander that his career was over. I'm going to cite Discern Report as the source for all of this information, but it was very strange. You've got a plane that doesn't really crash, but it certainly didn't land the way it was supposed to. It ran out long on the runway. It landed late on the runway. You could tell where it touched down and where it finally ran off the runway that it was too far down the runway. And the estimates for its speed were that it was going far too fast, far faster than a plane like a 767 is supposed to come to a stop by landing at a certain speed and then using the brakes to stop. Now, Discern Report says the story underneath it is older, uglier, and not a rumor invented on social media. The airplane has flown for Amazon by a company called 21 Air, which is a company out of Greensboro, North Carolina. It is a cargo outfit with an operation shop in Miami and a nickname in pilot forums that should have been a flashing light. They called it 21 Scare. They say the NTSB has not yet issued a probable cause, but it doesn't need 5 minutes to describe that last half a minute. The nose and the right main landing gear touched down at 158 knots. Now, you want to know an easy way to translate knots into miles an hour like the rest of us do? Add 15%. So call it 160 plus 15%, probably something like 175 or 180 miles an hour. The left landing gear stayed in the air for 11 seconds after the nose and the right landing gear had actually hit the ground. Now, what happened? The throttle, well, there were brakes on, brakes off, throttle shoved around, throttles pulled back to idle, brakes on again, no thrust reversers, no speed brakes. Does that sound like anybody knew what they were doing in the cockpit of that airplane? And they say the 767 that should have been stopped, a truck just got crashed into, and there were five people on board, all of them in a Ford van that belonged to Professional Ocean Service Corp. The flight was the airplane's third flight of the day. San Juan back to Miami after Cincinnati to Miami and Miami to San Juan. Thunderstorms were in the area. A tailwind gust near 30 miles an hour has been mentioned. Weather not an excuse for leaving the airplane in the air for one-third of a 9,000-foot runway and then changing your mind twice about whether or not you're landing or leaving. You understand go-arounds? I mean, I've been on airplanes where they've had to do a go-around because for whatever reason, the landing is not lining up properly and the pilot pours on the coal and pulls the airplane back up in the air, fly around, and start again. I mean, it's not that complicated. Is it probably embarrassing for a captain of a flight like that? Yeah. Captain Joseph Carroll, 55 years old, with more than 7,000 hours, and he got rated in the 767 in May of this year, 4 months before this landing. First officer had 2,600 hours in the airplane and an aeronautical engineering degree from Columbia University, both treated and released. So the question is, what was going on there? Was this diversity, equity, and inclusion? Was it hiring the cheapest, low bidder? What was going on there that 21 Air? Well, 21 Air is owned by Houston Astros owner Jim Crane. It is one of Amazon Air's contract carriers, according to Discern Report. And the pilot group, according to engineer Nick Plum's public resume review, has ballooned from about 20 in 2021 to 135 as Amazon shifted additional 767. So Amazon is anxious to be flying its own cargo. I understand that. They've hired a private company to actually fly the planes and move the cargo around. Well, here's the problem. They've been adding a lot of personnel. And they say a lot of those resumes show prior flying in Venezuela, Colombia, Peru, Central America, Ethiopia, and India, plus permanent residents and other work-authorized non-citizens. Was Amazon going cheap and hiring a company that was able to do it as the low bidder because they were hiring people from outside the country who might or might not have been qualified to fly the plane? It doesn't make any sense. Why in the world would you have a plane that touches down 9,000 feet into the runway, then you make the partial decision to go around, then you decide not to go around, then you don't do all the things that it would have taken to make that airplane stop in a timely fashion and not kill the five people on board that van? None of that makes sense, but we're going to talk to as many of our airline friends and airplane pilot friends as we can and see if we can find some better answers for you. But in the meantime, glad to have you with me. If you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it's 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com.
The Lars Larson Show. Portland's news traffic. Missed the Lars Larson Show today? Find Lars's thoughts and get the podcast right now at LarsLarson.com. Now, here's Lars Larson.
Hey, welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails. Donald Trump is trying to make peace with the angry cattle ranchers after his beef import plan seems to have backfired just a bit. Can two new executive orders actually undo that damage? I thought we'd ask that question of Sky Krebs, who's vice president of the National Cattlemen's Beef Association and a fourth-generation Eastern Oregon cattle and sheep rancher. Sky, welcome back.
Well, thanks, Lars. Good visiting with you again.
It's nice to talk to you as well. What has Donald Trump done right, and can this right fix what he's done already, or is he in trouble with America's cattle ranchers?
Well, it was a tough week when he made that announcement. We'd already had our share of bad news with Tyson closing some plants and selling the plant here in Wallula. So it was already a tough week. And then when he announced that he was bringing in 300,000 ton of imported beef, and then in the same breath asking us to accept it being sold 25% under market, no, we couldn't accept that. We're business people. That just doesn't make good business sense. Since then, he's done some positive things to try and right that. But we believe in a free market, Lars. This beef demand is good because people prefer beef. They've got alternatives out there. You can buy pork or poultry right now. You don't have to buy beef, but people prefer the value of beef. They enjoy it, and so our demand is good. And so let's let the free market take care of these things. We don't need government interference.
Well, in fact, do you have some? Well, let me start with this question first. Who do you think is advising him? And does he? I mean, is he clear now that maybe some of the people advising him have been steering him the wrong direction?
Well, we don't know that, Lars. Secretary Rollins has done a lot of good things for the industry. Whether she was a part of that, we just don't know that. So, I mean, this doesn't make any economic sense. How do you expand production and then ask the people producing it to take less money? It makes no economic sense at all. So we don't have the inside scoop on that. If he'd have visited with us, we would have set him on the right path. But unfortunately, that ship has sailed.
Okay. And when they give the numbers, when they say that 7 years ago, we had something like 94 million head of cattle and calves, and that now it's more like 86. So there's been a drop of maybe 10%. But what is that telling you about the marketplace? Since you're right, America's cattle ranchers are, for the most part, you're subject to the marketplace. And you're willing to do it that way because that's the right way to run things, right?
That's correct. You know, a lot of factors are playing into the decrease in the numbers. Drought being number one. You look at the drought monitor maps, most of the country is in deep drought. There's just not a lot of forage availability. The drought was so bad a few years ago, you know, people had to sell because you can't feed your cows out of a drought. You go broke doing that. So if the drought cycle would break, we get some forage, the numbers will start coming up. I've visited with you before about this predator issue. This is huge. We're feeding X amount of our production to the gray wolf, the Mexican wolf, the grizzly bears, the black vultures. So all these factors come up with a decreasing herd. But we can fix that, but we can't have interference sending mixed signals.
Okay, so what are the things you could do quickly? I mean, for example, you mentioned the wolves and the other predators. These are apex predators, mostly inserted at the order of government. Is there a way to quickly act on that and maybe sell some wolf tags somewhere?
Well, that is one of the things that they've come out since the announcement about the imported beef, is he has ordered the Secretary of Interior to study delisting some of these fully recovered predators. We don't need to study it anymore. They just need to do it. But, you know, thank God they threw us a bone. At least it elevated the discussion about it. There's a bill currently in the Senate. Our two senators could sign it if they wanted, the Pet and Livestock Protection Act, that would turn the management of the wolves back to the state. So, again, we've elevated the conversation. Wolves is a big one, obviously, but, you know, throw in the rest of them. Throw in the endangered fish, the salmon and all that. All these things have played in decreasing production of our livestock industry.
I'm talking to Sky Krebs, who's vice president of the National Cattlemen's Beef Association and a fourth-generation cattle and sheep rancher. So are there any other things you could get in the way of relief from federal regulations or things that are under the control of the president or the Congress or the bureaucracy that might help the industry out in the short run?
Well, like I said, you know, Secretary Rollins has outlined some things. They have expanded the grazing on our federal lands. They're opening up some of these vacant allotments. Again, that's in the processing. You got to get NEPA and all that done, but they're encouraging conversations about getting some of the additional forage opened up.
Sky, can I interrupt? Because,
sure.
You know, when you've got half the West on fire every year, and you could have your animals out at least reducing the fuel load on those lands. Wouldn't that have a dual benefit?
Exactly. I mean, wildfire mitigation is huge on these catastrophic fires that we keep seeing because grazing has been decreased. Getting that grazing numbers back up there, reducing those fine fuels. It's a win-win. You're expanding the herd, the opportunities, and you're decreasing the wildfire list. So they're talking about it. You know, they're moving at government speed, which is similar to a glacier, but at least we're visiting with it.
Well, I mean, that's the kind of thing that just drives me crazy, is when you say, well, we could have a whole lot less of the West on fire if you just let them get the cattle and the sheep out there and chew down some of that grass. It doesn't take the fire danger away 100%, but it dramatically drops it if you reduce the fuel load. Any other things that Brooke Rollins could do as Secretary of USDA?
Well, obviously... Yeah, any time you're reducing the red tape, and she seems committed to doing that. The permitting processes, they're always long. You know, NEPA documents, 10 years to write. Oh, my God, that's ridiculous. Reduce the pages down there to just get it back to a simpler form. We don't need these huge documents that just take years to write. We're currently in the Blue Mountain Forest revision. I think we've been working on that 20 years, Lars, and I'm not exaggerating. On that, so you know, we're making steps. It's going to take a long time to turn this all around. This, you know, this has been slow creep upon us over the last 40 years. Government intervention. You're not going to write it overnight, but we're talking a lot of good things that need to happen, but it's going to take time. So you know, the president didn't do us a favor on importing the beef, but since then he's given us some positive things that if we can get them implemented, we'll help the industry.
That's the way to get it done. That's Sky Krebs from the National Cattlemen's Beef Association. Sky, thanks very much. You got the Lars Larson Show. You need to sell fast.
Lars Larson wants to hear from you, even if you disagree. Naysayers get to cut the line at 866-HEY-LARS. Now, here's Lars Larson.
Hey, welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Wednesday. Glad to have you with me on the Radio Northwest Network, too. And if you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it's right here at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@larslarson.com. And, boy, I'll tell you what, the continued commentary on the Lindsey Clancy jury, I think, is absolutely correct. You've got 11 jury members who are trying to persuade the public. We didn't want to convict her of a crime. Well, why not? Well, because she used to be a good mom. Do you know what's crazy about all of this? She used to be a good mom is your defense. Because anybody who used to be a good person still must be that good person. I got to tell you something. Having covered any number of murder trials over the years, I can't tell you how many times I had people tell me, why, we lived right next to him for 5 years. He seemed like a perfectly normal, nice guy. I heard that about almost every single murder case I ever covered. The only one that I didn't hear that about was Diane Downs, who tried to murder her 3 children. She tried to do what Lindsey Clancy did. And Lindsey Clancy, though, I guess, is an entirely different era for America. When Susan Smith murdered her kids, America was ready to go out and string her up like tomorrow. And in the case of Lindsey Clancy, all of a sudden you've got a bunch of jurors who say, well, but she was a very good mom. You could tell she really, really loved her kids, and she would do anything for her kids. Yeah, including killing her kids. I mean, this stuff absolutely makes no sense, that somehow you're going to excuse the actions of this mom because she used to be a good mom. And one of the sound bites that I played for you is where one of the jurors complains that the prosecution seemed so harsh right out of the gate, that they didn't put on any character witnesses to speak to the kind of character that Lindsey Clancy exhibited. And you think, hold on, the job of the prosecution is to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the accused is guilty of the crime. And I want to tell you something else. Now, this may seem like a thin item to talk about, but there were a number of nurses on the jury. There were 9 women and there were 3 men. And only one of those people actually voted to say, I'm not going to vote to acquit her. And I thought that was the right decision. But some of the people who were on that jury were nurses as a profession. And they did something, they've admitted doing something that is absolutely completely out of line. It made all kinds of sense that if there hadn't been a mistrial for any other reason, there was a good reason to have a mistrial. And the reason was this. Some of the members of the jury went into the jury room and then they gave their professional opinion as nurses about the toxicology reports that were done on Lindsey Clancy. And I know this takes some explanation, but bear with me on this. So Lindsey Clancy was on a number of drugs. There were toxicology reports done. And apparently in the jury room, some of the nurses who were on the jury decided to tell the other jury members what they knew about those toxicology reports because of their training as nurses. Do you know why that's completely out of line? And I called and I talked to our favorite former prosecutor, Josh Markey, about this. And I said, Josh, I seem to remember cases where somebody goes into a jury room and every single juror is expected to bring their own life experience to being a jury. But then they have to make their decision based on the testimony that they hear in court, and only the testimony that they hear in court. Jurors are not allowed to use, I read something in the newspaper. They are not allowed to go out and do their own independent investigation. And that's actually happened before. I recall cases where members of a jury, when they weren't sequestered, would actually drive out to the scene where the crime happened to do their own investigation. That is completely off limits for anybody who serves on a jury. But one of the other things, and this one is harder to understand. So let's say you come to the jury and you are by profession a police officer, but you're serving on a jury. As a police officer, you're allowed to use what you know from your profession in evaluating the things you heard in court during testimony that the judge allowed to be given. Because remember, the judge signs off and says yes to every single witness that the jury gets to hear. And judges are very careful about that sometimes too careful, because a judge could say, I don't want this to be heard by the jury because it will merely inflame the emotions of the jury. But having said that, the judge decides what testimony the jury gets to hear and what testimony they don't get to hear. That's one thing. The second thing is, anytime somebody testifies in a trial, the testimony may be given on behalf of the prosecution or given on behalf of the defense. But both sides get to cross-examine every single witness and ask them other questions about what they know and what they're telling the jury. And the jury hears all of that. When you go into the jury room, if there were nurses in there who were giving their professional opinion of what they thought of the toxicology reports that were done on Lindsey Clancy, they were completely out of line. It is as though you're saying, we're going to let a member of the jury testify to the rest of the jury. You're not allowed to do that. You are allowed to use everything you heard during the course of the trial. You're allowed to use every scrap of testimony by the witnesses who are brought in. You're allowed to use all the things that you saw when they were physical pieces of evidence, a knife, a gun, a bullet, blood, whatever it happens to be. What you're not allowed to do as a member of the jury is to add testimony where you're going to act like an expert witness and say, well, I'm an expert on that subject, so therefore what was testified to in court is simply not possible. If you do that, you're doing something that merits a mistrial. And it sounds like that's exactly what the juror members jury members are now admitting that they did in that jury room while they were trying to bully one of the jurors into voting for not guilty. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson Show. FM News 101.